Thank you. It's May 30th, Memorial Day. Some people in America are still, I'm sure, having their barbecues.
Forgot about that. Yes, okay.
The schedule again, just for me, next week, of course, there's no class, and I will not be here in 2 weeks. In 3 weeks and in 4 weeks, there will be class, and then it'll stop for the summer. We've been going, with the exception of Yom Tov, every single day, every single Monday, without exception, since September. And then we were doing that before the summer and even most of the summer. In fact, today is my 100th YouTube talk. And there's about 50,000 views on YouTube. I don't know about the ones that listen just for a notion, but the YouTube, you can see. So that's very nice. So it's auspicious, but we'll go a few more times. Many, many correspondences. I gotta show you some interesting things. Leon contacted me. He called my attention to the following. We spoke about Lefrak. Oops. And here's a story from the Hoosier State Chronicles that Samuel Lefrak, or we said Lefrak, but it's, we say, let me see, Wikipedia says it's Lefrak. Wealthy builder who was this year honored as Outstanding Jew of the Year by the Interfaith Movement. It goes on that first it says that his walls boast pictures of him in comradely company with heads of almost every ultra-Orthodox yeshiva in the country. But his office this week, there was a sit-in, and among the people there was Rabbi Kurt Flasher, a graduate of Yeshiva Heichal HaTorah. He's now the administrator, and he's also active in CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, and he used to go on freedom rides. So what's going on there? Why? Well, lo and behold, you can read the article that in Lefrak City they didn't allow blacks, or as they called them then, Negroes, to rent. So for all the good tzedakah and everything, this is not actually a good story. But I was curious who this. I never heard of it. She was Heichal HaTorah. I know Heichal HaTorah today in Teaneck. I never heard of a Heichal HaTorah in the 60s. And a guy who's active in CORE, a rabbi who's fighting for racial equality. I actually looked around a little I found a whole article on one of the freedom rides with non-Orthodox rabbi, Brother Kurt Flasher, was waging a 6-day hunger strike in jail. And then lo and behold, where is it? the wedding of Rabbi Nathaniel Steinberg, who I knew. He was at my wedding. who was his best man? None other than Rabbi Kurt Flasher. Some of you probably know Nate Steinberg. Unfortunately, he passed away, but he was living in Vacation Village. I knew him for 20 years. So if anyone knows this Rabbi Kurt Flasher, to see someone in the 60s, an Orthodox rabbi who's so involved in the civil rights movement, that to me I find interesting. So thank you very much, Leon, for that. We were having discussions last class. I was thinking, and as we were speaking about it, gone, is it muktzah? At first I said it would be a problem, and then I'm thinking, and I said, the more I think about it, I don't think it's a muktzah, so I Googled it, and of course it's a machlokas. You can Google it, you can read it. Obviously, a gun, the action of the gun is, there's a malacha there, you're igniting a fire, I guess you could say, but it's a machlokas whether it's a muktzah. Because the question is the, at least how it's explained, I'm seeing, okay, a thing on the OU here, is the point of the gun intimidation, or is the point really to shoot someone? If you hold it's intimidation, then Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach says it's not muktzah, and Rav Goren also says it's not muktzah because it's pikuach nefesh, but others, Rav Shlomo Minhar and others, hold it is muktzah because... it's a klisha malachto isor. Only if it's like mamish, a matter of pikuach nefesh, could you bring it. But you couldn't just bring it like people do in Boca my brother's show. Every Shabbos, they just go packing. That I think, not according to Rav Shlomo Zalman, according to the others, it would be a problem. But if it's only for intimidation, then Rav Shlomo Zalman holds it's not buksa. So it's good that we had that discussion. One of you asked me, we spoke, this goes back a few classes, but I want to get to it because we have a break, about selling the aliyahs. And someone said, well, how is that permitted on Shabbos? Isn't that Mekach or Memkar? Well, you can take a look at Yechavadas of Rav Avadiah Yosef on, in volume 2, number 41. And he discusses this and he explains, no, it's not. Why isn't it? For the simple reason that it's considered Chefzei Shamayim. It's no different than raising money for poor people. In fact, the Gemara says explicitly, let me show you a Gemara. Rav Avadiah quotes this Gemara. It's in Shabbos. No, where's my Shabbos here? Oh, here. Where it says that you can't do thing. What can you do? Meshadchin al tinokos leiris b'Shabbos al tinok ulando sefer ulando umnos. That translation is you can make arrangements to betroth children, finding someone to teach them to read books and teach them a craft. So you're allowed to do that. Why? Because it's this is considered a mitzvah. Now, I bet you most of you know this passage from your Zemiros, by the way. What do we have in the Zemiros? Mayedidos, right? Mayedidos, you all know it. So it says here, what can it says the things you can't do and the things you can do. So it says over here, we know that you can't do these monetary calculations here in Mutarim, you are okay. Then it says, Vesino, Vetinok, Lamdo Sefer, you can arrange, it means they're to arrange for a child to study. Lamnat Seach, Banginot. What does that have to do with anything? We just saw what the Gemara said. The Gemara said what did the Gemara say? It said you can. Lando Sefer, Lando Umnus, and also you can do a Shidduch. So you can arrange for him to be taught, as it says, for someone to teach him how to read books. And why is it over here, if you go back to it, why does it have Lamnat Seach Binginot? To arrange for a child to be taught, I think many assume it's even it's Torah matters. And then to sing a song of praise. What's that about? It's not clear why they substituted it, unless it's been suggested that Rabbi Mazur suggested it, that there came a time when people stopped teaching their children a parnasa. Although it's an explicit statement of Chazal that to have to teach your son a profession, and if you don't, you're teaching him gezeila. We know that if you go into, for example, the Haredi world, it's very common where they don't do that anymore. They don't feel it's binding. It's important. And it's not just something new. This has been an issue going back a long time. So Rabbi Mazuz speculates that when people just decided that they're not, for whatever reason, I'm not sure how they got out of this, but although the Rambam, as I recall, the Rambam mentions this. He doesn't mention teaching to swim. I think he mentions teaching umnos. I know he doesn't mention teaching to swim. I can't remember. I got to check. I think he might actually, Rambam might omit in the Mishnah Torah umnos also. But when they stopped teaching it, then they replaced it. Perhaps. I don't know. But in terms of shul, you're absolutely allowed to auction off the aliyahs, although it might not look good. People might like it. Last class, we were speaking about Rabbi Zalman Geiger. And I thank the brother of Abraham Geiger. We'll get to Abraham in a second. And I thank Naftali for calling my attention to when he deals with Simchas Torah. He mentions that new people have come in, and now they've adopted the Minhag Poland of doing hakafos, not dancing, but actually just the hakafos going around. And Naftali says that refers to Hirsch. I looked, he mentions, and this goes back to 1818, where he's recording Minhagim, he mentions the Chadodi. So what I was told, or what I heard, that Frankfurt, the main kahila, was very late in adopting the Chadodi, we see already in the early 19th century they did it. So leave that at that. And one final thing I want to deal with, and that's the issue of Brich Shemeh. I got a lot of comments about that. Before I get to that, about the muggers on Shabbos, and I said, we hold that money, you can't carry money on Shabbos. Although the Ethiopians do carry money. And in this book that was written by this Ethiopian rabbi, who's now a rabbi of a Dati Lomi Shul, which has the approbation of a Shabtai Kohen Rappaport and Nachum Rabinovitz, he says that the Ethiopians just bring money to Shul on Shabbos and give tzedakah. He says that for the old Ethiopians, that this is their minhag. He gives a hector. He says they can still do it. And the younger generation, we teach them otherwise. What I would like to point out, and he was attacked for this, that he's a reformer, and how could these rabbis give a haskama to it? I think Gershon Bacon, for calling my attention, Professor Gershon Bacon, if you look in the Otzar Chiluf Minhagim, which is the Chilukim from the Gonic period of Bavo and Eretz Yisrael on page 65, it says that B'nai Eretz Yisrael wouldn't carry money. They wouldn't even touch money, but B'nai Bavo would carry money. And they did not regard it as muktza. For whatever reason is, they didn't regard it as muktza money. So that's interesting. The last thing I want to mention deals with Brich Shemay. Some of you asked me, well, what about the Rav? Did the Rav say Brich Shemay? And I said that I don't remember it. I thank a number of people who called my, Heshi and a couple others. Well, first of all, in this I knew, but I forgot. Mipnine Harav, page 42. I knew it because I read it, but I forgot it. The other thing, no, I didn't know at all. So I especially thank people for that. It quotes Rav Lichtenstein that Rav Chaim, he got this from Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim was very mocked not to say Bar Elohim, Samichana, that we depend on Bar Elohim. I'm going to show you in a second here. Let me show you this. This is the problematic passage. So here's Brich Shemay. So it says, we don't rely on individuals. V'or bar Elohim samichna. So what does bar Elohim mean? So Rav Chaim thought that it means son of God. And we don't use language like that. Although if you look in Daniel, in the chapter, was it chapter 3, I think? Chapter 3, verse 25, it says that he saw a vision, and it says it's like Demeg of Ar Elohim, like an angel. That's how Rashi explains it. That's how everyone understands it. Now, Rav Schachter quotes that, yes, he quotes this Pasuk, but he says that even though the Pasuk in the, we see Nebuchadnezzar was referring to an angel, nevertheless, he calls attention to the Yerushalmi that Nebuchadnezzar was punished for using that language. So we see that it's not proper language. But this says nothing about Rav Chaim not saying it, other than not saying that expression. However, I think it was Heshi who called my attention to, in the Hanhagos HaRav, in the Rav Zemachsor, it quotes Rabbi Wolgamuth, Isaiah Wolgamuth from Boston, who I knew a bit because I lived there. Unfortunately, I only schmoozed with him. I went to his house to visit him one time. I didn't take advantage. If I'm not mistaken, it was his grandson who was killed hit by a car, right? And was that Elizabeth or Passaic? Because it said Wolgamuth from Boston. But this was just a few weeks ago. But I didn't, Rabbi Wolgamuth from Berlin Rabbinical Seminary and very, very close to Rabbi Soloveitchik. I never took advantage of the time there. But in his notes, he put together notes of the Rav and Tefillah. He says that in his later years, the Rav completely omitted Brich Shemay. So I don't know if someone's at the Maimonides Minyan, tell me what they do there. So I also said, though, what is this, this expression, Bar Elohim? And I said it's problematic because it could mean son of God, although if you look in Daniel, it's not. And I mentioned this book. This is the Desola Pool. No one uses this anymore, the traditional prayer book. It was only like a Shabbos prayer book. I don't know how many shuls had it. It was never as popular as Birnbaum. But if you look in the Brich Shemay, this is how he translates it. Not on man do I rely, nor do I lean on a son of God, but only on the God of the heavens. There was a huge dispute about this in Hadoar in the 1960s with Rabbi Paltiel, not Rabbi, sorry, Dr. Paltiel Birnbaum, Philip Birnbaum. Here's a, it's rare sitter. If maybe in your show, you'll find it in the storage room. I got this from my brothers from my show. You know, I found one on the stacks. I don't know what they did with all the Sidurim. You probably get it very cheap. But if you look on, when the first time Baruch Shemei appears, he translates it the same way Art Scroll and Sachs do, that not on Mandrapon Trust, nor on any angel. And in the note, he says where this is from. They had a big, so he has a big polemic against the Desola Pool Siddur. How can you say it means son of God? And Rabbi Chevelle responded, and Susanna reminded me what Rav Chevelle said, and I don't, if anyone has a copy of it, I have to get to the library and get the Hador. It's not online. As I recall, Rabbi Chevelle said that it's actually what, this is what Susanna mentioned, it's an anti-Christian polemic. That you're saying that I don't rely on man, I don't rely on a son of God. That is, in English, we put son of God in quotes, because it's not really a son of God, meaning that it's anti-Christian. But Birnbaum obviously doesn't accept that. This is so far-fetched that it's hard to imagine that this is what this passage in the Zohar is referring to. I think it's obvious it refers to angel, and that's the meaning in the pasuk. You should know that the Desola Pool Siddur had had problems among the rabbinic elite. I'm holding in my hand now a page from Hapardes. You can go online and look at it, February 1961, where the Agudas Rabbanim says as follows: Hasidur Hanipas. That is the Desola Pool Siddur. Asur lehishtameshbo. You cannot use it. This is a cheirim long before Kamenetsky and before Slifkin. The RCA Siddur was put in cheirim. People don't realize this. Not only is it forbidden to use it, you can't. It's asur lemkoroso and it's asur leknoso. You can't even buy it. And what do you do with this RCA Siddur? This one I have right here. According to the Gudas Rabbonim, to him, to unim geniza. I'm not putting in geniza. Because I need it. It's important. But and not only that, the Gudas Rabbanim says you have to publicize the full Bate Kinesios concerning this Isser, and you have to lavo bidvorim imenale histodus Rabbanim. You have to get in touch with the RCA lashpia lehem to shayim shechu asiyadam in a sitter. They have to convince the RCA to back off this sitter or vatelas kol mifal and to stop this whole thing. So what's the problem with this sitter? Well, they have six things. It says the Targum is incorrect. It destroys Kavanos of Tefillah. It changes the Matbeah of the Chachamim. It's in places against the Halacha. I don't know what that refers to. They translate it against the Pshat. Shir HaShirim is translated in Ofen Chiloni. I guess they translated it literally, so it's not just Art Scroll that wanted to do this. And then it says, in some places, there's a possibility of falling into minus. Minus refers to heresy, but it usually, not just heresy, in Talmud, minus usually refers to Christianity, Judeo-Christian. So in other words, they say that the Desola Pool Siddur has a Christian element to it. Now, it doesn't tell you what this, but I'm telling you it's Bar Elohim. The fact that this Siddur translates Bar Elohim as a son of God, that we that's what it's referring to, that's minus. But as I just said, Reb Chaim, according to the Rav, Reb Chaim understood this to also mean that whether he's right or wrong is neither here nor there, because if Reb Chaim, I guess Reb Chaim don't say it, so he saw it as a problem, and he didn't. Reb Chaim did not see it as a an issue of anti-Christian, I think. I don't know what he might have saw it as one of these interpolations in the Zohar, which are inappropriate. We're going to talk very soon today about interpolations. If you can have interpolations in the Gemara and wait till you see who calls attention to a quasi-heretical interpolation in the Gemara, you can have it in other places as well. And you have in the Zohar, definitely. You've had traditional authorities who speak about interpolations, quasi-heretical interpolations. So we'll get to maybe that. But okay, I'm all up where I need to be now. And let us return. If you recall, the last thing we did, as I mentioned, that Geiger one of his early writings. It's a scholarly essay on the Mishnah, interpreting it at odds with the Gemara, which is provocative. It shows you his independent mind. You can maybe trace where he's going to end up. And I do think today that I said this last class, if you'd walk into a typical Beis Medrash, it doesn't have to be a Beis Medrash of, people in black pants and white shirts. You can walk into the YU Beis Medrash and just mention that, I want to interpret what the Mishnah says, not like the Gemara. I think they'll not only be very uncomfortable, many people would probably say, well, this is heretical, you can't do that. And I pointed out last week, it's not the case. The Tosfos Yom Tov, and this is the last thing we read, the Tosfos Yom Tov, and he's a commentary on the Mishnah on the spot there. He's not just writing an article. He interprets that Mishnah in Nazir against the Gemara, and he says it's not a problem because I'm not changing halacha. And that's where we ended. And I also said that the Rambam does the same thing. But before we go further with this, and the Tosfos Yom Tov says, I'm doing the exact same thing that the commentators do on the Torah. That is, that the Gemara says this is what the Pasuk means, but yet they interpret it al pi pshat. So if they do that, then with the Torah, I can do that with the Mishnah. Why would anyone want to do this? That's first the question. We understand Geiger, he's interpreting just from a scholarly perspective. But if you're writing a commentary in the Torah, and let's say Chazal tell you, if the word la'olam, let's say, if it means until the Yovel, why would you interpret it like Rashbam does about the Eved as meaning forever? Or why would you interpret if the Chazal tell you that the day starts in the evening? Why would you say, well, the Pshat of Breishit is that actually, yes, Chazal say that, but Pshat is that the day starts in the morning. After all, Vahi Erev, Vahi Voker. That is, you have the evening, and then you have the morning, and then the day starts after the morning. Then the day starts, not in the evening. The day finishes in the morning, let's say, at dawn. Why would anyone want to do this? And don't think this is just the Rashbam. Everyone knows the Rashbam. The Rashbam even interprets tefillin. Al pi pshat, not to be literal. It means like place God near your heart. And we have Ibn Ezra, although Ibn Ezra, it's a question, because Ibn Ezra, how great a Talmudist was he? Ibn Ezra says he's only going to interpret in line with halacha, so he disagrees with the halacha. It's been suggested, well, he didn't know these Gemaras, but the Rashbam obviously knew the Gemaras. The Rashbam is one of the greatest of the Rishonim. Why? Why interpret it this way? And don't think it's just the Rashbam. We have this again and again. We even have Rashi. Rashi does this. If you don't believe me, here's just one example, famous. Look in Shmos chapter 23, Alacha Beis. Rashi goes through, cites what the Gemara says, and right at the end, and what Unko says, he says, although this is what the Gemara says, I'm going to explain it al pi pshat. The Ramban does this. What's the logic? Who are you, even if you're a great Rishon, and what's the point of explaining if Chazal tell us this, and how far do you take this? Are you then going to say the pshat of Ayin Tachas Ayin is literal? It's not clear really what the angle is here because they don't explain it. And there could be different approaches in different cases. In some cases, it could be what they're saying is that although this is derived in the Gemara, this should be understood as a derabbanan, the rabbis, but not... But not actual Torah rules. But in many other cases, 100% they agree that this is the Torah law. But the attitude is that there's multiple levels, multivalent. So therefore, yes, it's minatari. You have to put the tefillin is minatari, literal tefillin. But that's the drash. And the drash is minatari. The drash is daraisa. But there's also the pshat. And the pshat has value. Pshat has value even at odds with the accepted halacha, even at odds with the drash. The drash is what tells us what the halacha is. The pshat tells us what the pshat is. And the fact that it was put, take the ayin tachas ayin, the fact that it was put in form of ayin tachas ayin, that has value. I understand there are many people who disagree and they say, no, the pshat is, I think Artscroll might even say, the pshat is monetary, but no, that's according to some, but many say absolutely not. In fact, they say that dafka, the pshat, is a value because we should have done what it's trying to teach you. The lesson is that we should, in theory, do eye and Takasai in, but we can't because one eye is going to be better than another eye, et cetera, et cetera. So therefore, we're forced to do monetary. So pshat always has value, even shira shirim, I would say. Again, although if you look at Art Scroll, and apparently the Agudas Rabbanim who attacked the Desola pool sitter Shira Shirim. So what is, I mean, he's trans, I just look at Friday night. Why don't we talk? You know what Shira Shirim means. But at the end of the day, it was written in Hebrew. So it does mean something. The Peshat has value. But there's another value. There's the non-Peshat has value. That's how I think most understand it. And that's why the Rashbam and others will explain that. And what Rashi is doing right here, that yes, there is the halacha, we're bound to the halacha practice, but the Peshat opens up other avenues, multi-levels. If it's the divine word, Torah, there's not just one level, there's multi-levels, and the Peshat is telling us something. By the way, there was, since we spoke about Frankfurt, I'll tell you something else about Frankfurt, and we have some Frankfurt people usually with us. When the son-in-law of Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, Rabbi Breuer, the first Rabbi Breuer, Shlomo
Zalman.
Shlomo Zalman, yes. Okay, so when he died, who's supposed to take it over his position? Well, it was expected that would be his son, Rafael Breuer, who was rabbi, as I recall, in Aschaffenburg at that time. I can't remember, but there was a problem.
Correct.
Aschaffenburg, thank you. There was a problem. Naftali, you probably know the problem. There's actually two problems, but one of the big problems was he published two commentaries on Shira Shirim. But one of the commentaries was which he focused on the Pshat, not denying the other meanings, that the most fundamental meaning is that Shira Shirim reflects the allegory of man and God and Kal Yisrael or anything like that. But the fact is, it was put in the form of human love because that's also holy. And we're not Catholics here. We do, medieval Catholics. We do believe that love between a man and a woman is something holy. And that's what he elaborated on. I think today people would find that very refreshing and not have a problem with it. But this created such a controversy. He was attacked, and this was actually, and then the people opposed to him, they were opposed to him for other reasons, but they used this as like a witch hunt, as a way of pressuring the community that he's not a reliable Rav. What a chil Hashem he did by publishing this. And even Rabbi Reines, the head of the Mizrahi, got in because this was a way then to attack the Breuers for their anti-Zionism. So then he published another commentary, which is more traditional. And that's never been translated into English.
The second one. All of Raphael Breuer's Perushim on the Megillos are all now available from Feldheim, all five.
No, but I'm saying that's the second translation.
Oh, the first one you can hardly even find in German.
Okay, so the first one is the rare one, and it should be translated into English. Unfortunately, Mrs. Hirscher is not around, because like I said, I think we're at the age that we can appreciate that the love, especially in the era where many people are saying that the love of man and woman is not special, that we need to affirm that there's something special about something kedusha about man and woman. The fact that you had a Rav of such, and he was of good stature from obviously great Yichus, wanted to elaborate. It's almost like he prophesied without knowing what he prophesied, that 100 years later, we could actually use a work that speaks about how man and woman, that love is actually something special. But that's what, and he obviously didn't think it would be a problem. So we have many examples of this, but what's with the Mishnah? Well, the Vilna Gaon does it also. The Vilna Gaon explains the Mishnah at odds with the Gemara, and as does his student, Rabbi Nasha of Ilya. If you look in the famous Tiferes Yisrael, where is it? It's the beginning of Baba Kama? I forget where the Tiferes Yisrael quotes Rabbi Nasha. And the Vilna Gaon, the Gemara had a student called Binyamin Rivlin. He wrote a book. You can find it on HebrewBooks.org, Otzer Chachma, Gavi Kesef, in which he says as follows. You look on page Chaf. Page 23b, I heard from my master, the Gaon of the Gra, that the Mishnah is interpreted as Pshat and Drash. So here we have a Masora from the Vilna Gaon that you can interpret the Mishnah, as long as you don't affect Halacha. You can interpret the Mishnah different levels, and there's nothing wrong with that. And like I said last class, those of us who study Gemara, sometimes you have experiences where you wonder, well, is this really what the Gemara meant? And then you look in Yerushalmi sometimes, and you see the Yerushalmi doesn't even offer that interpretation. And there is a tradition, I don't know today if you go into yeshivas how accepted it is, but there is such a tradition, the Nitziv. The Nitziv says as follows. You can find this in Hamek Shalah. He says, it's the manner of the Gemara of Akeim. I think the best translation of Akeim is to contort the explanation of the Mishnah to bring it into line with the final halacha. What the Nitziv says is that they have a Masora, they know this is the halacha. The Mishnah seems to say otherwise. And therefore, they interpret the Mishnah in a dochak way, which is not the pshad in the Mishnah, which is not therefore what the Mishnah really meant. But they interpret it this way in order that it be in line with the final halacha. That's what the Nitziv says. Furthermore, then it gets into the complicated issue because sometimes these explanations, which are very dochak, you can look at the Sri Yesh and others who explain, they're not really by the Maharaim, they're by the Savarayim. So are we bound by the Savarayim? Halacha, we are. But the Sri Yesh has no problem explaining that certain Gemaras, that this is the Savarayim offering an explanation, but he doesn't think that that's what the Amoraim or that's what the Tanaim had in mind. Now, all the examples I just gave you, including the Sri Yesh, but the Gra and the Tosas Yom Tov, the Rambam, they're all, the Menashe Avilia, they're all ad hoc. It's not a Shita, though. The first one to do this as a shita is this individual. I just made a copy. I couldn't find a picture online, so I made a copy today from the Encyclopedia Judaica. And this is, his name was Hirsch Mendel Pinellas. And you can see it looks like a from Jew, and although, well, a religious maskil. But he wrote a book. And the book is called, Darka Shel Torah. You can see it in HebrewBooks.org. And you can see the title there. It says, L'hatztik HaTorah Shebal Peh B'Klal O'Hagen Ol HaMishnah B'Frat. That is, this volume is designed to explain the Mishnah. He says, to defend the Mishnah. What does it mean to defend the Mishnah? To defend the Mishnah against interpretations in the Gemara that are not al pi pshat. And he stresses, of course, that we follow the Gemara when it comes to halacha, but when it comes to pshat, he says we can follow this tradition of explaining it. Now, this was very, very controversial, as you can imagine, because it's not, first of all, the whole idea is controversial. Second of all, to make it a shita as opposed to ad hoc. So his brother-in-law wrote a two-volume work. Now, you remember, Pinellas is called Darka Shel Torah, Kachi Darka Shel Torah. This is the way of Torah. Laharos Sitkas Chazal, to show that Chazal were correct in how they interpreted the Mishnah. Moshe Waldberg, now you can imagine that they didn't get together for Seder or anything like this, because this, his brother-in-law really blasts Pinellas big time. And this remains a dispute. The person who also did this was, Rabbi, the Rav of, hold on, I have it here, this individual, the Rav of Amsterdam, big Talmud Chacham, Halachic authority. His name was Rav Yosef Tzvi Dunner, Yosef Hirsch Dunner. He, the Dunners today are from his family, Pinny Dunner, the rest, not descended directly by his brother. So this is Rav Yosef Tzvi Dunner, dies in 1911. He published four volumes on the Shas. Here's one of them. You can see here, published in Frankfurt. You can see the volumes. Sometimes you see them in Bate Midrash. They look like this. The four big volumes, the red volumes. Rabbi Dunner follows this as a shita on sugya after sugya, explaining the Gemara, the Mishnah at odds with the Gemara. In fact, Halivni, who also follows this approach in his introduction, he doesn't like Dunner so much. He says that, well, Pinellas' book is much smaller, It's much better. And that's an issue. It's just something, look, we're not dealing with Talmud here. Rabbi Kalman could, he's had in the past the Ravadim classes that dealt with this as well. But you should be aware that this was a huge issue in the 19th century, so much so that the rabbis of Frankfurt wanted to put Rabbi Duner's commentary in Chirim. I have all the material, or I shouldn't say all, but a lot of the material on this, because the late Professor Mordechai Breuer, before he passed away, I guess he figured he was never going to get around to writing it. He sent me all of this material he had dealing with the dispute over the Duner commentary and the attempt to put it in the Chayrim. So one day I'll put it together, and I'm going to come back to Duner in a few minutes. There never was a Chayrim put out by Frankfurt against it, but that was what they wanted to do. And I will get back to Duner, because he's also known for something else. Really, I take this, what they want to put the commentary in Chayrim is really not for this. It's what I'm going to show you in a few minutes, that they wanted to put the commentary in Chayrim. So let's return to Geiger, who, as I said, before Pinellas and before Duner, he published an article setting his name out there with this approach. And what made Geiger so significant is because, as I said, he was a great scholar. And he set out to use his scholarship in the service of reform in a way that whole time wasn't and others weren't. He's going to use scholarship in the service of reform to show if you can show that there have been reforms in the past and changes, then we can do it as well. He, of course, would have a huge break and battle with the traditionalists, his old chavrusa and friend from Bonn, Hirsch. I don't believe they ever spoke when they left Bonn. When Hirsch published his Chorev, which was designed to assert the fundamentals of Jewish law from the Torah, Geiger responds very sharply. What for Hirsch was scholarship, for Geiger is a form of modern midrash, where basically he says Hirsch can make the text say whatever he wants to say. Now, the truth is that you had in Berlin at the rabbinical seminary, many of them also were not so enamored by Hirsch's commentaries, because Hirsch engages in a form of speculative etymology. But Geiger just wants nothing to do with it. And Geiger's point is that there is no tradition. As he sees it, the rabbis are inventing, they're inventing all these drashot, they're creating all these laws from whole cloth, and they're just attaching them to psukim. So there's no actual tradition. And if that's what you're trying to do, well, that's going to enable you to discredit the authority of the halachic system. We all know that there are halachot established on a repetition of a word, a letter here, and that's traditionally understood to be a biblical authority. Now, it doesn't mean, I mean, you could also say that the rabbis have the authority to derive, and that gives it biblical authority. But for Geiger, this is all a game, and the rabbis, as we'll see, are the Pharisees, they're all motivated by other factors, and they, so there's nothing really authentic going on here. Well, obviously, people are not going to be inspired to keep the law. But not only that, there's no reason to keep the law if this is if it's all this sort of linguistic game that the rabbis are playing, and they don't have any authority. It's not like they have authority from the Torah, which traditionalists assume that there's authority given to the sages to do drashot. And therefore, what this means is that all the derivations, everything rabbinic, and remember, we are rabbinic Judaism. We're not Karaites. We're not biblical Judaism. If all of rabbinic Judaism is shown to not have anything to stand on, it's just the rabbis inventing things and they don't have the authority to invent these things, well, then we're not bound by any of this. And the only thing left is then going to be the Bible. But even the Bible, we'll see, we're not going to be bound, as we saw already from Holdheim, by most of it as well. Geiger is often regarded as the founding father of Reformed Judaism. We know, we already saw, he didn't begin it. It began already the generation before him. But he really brings everything together, the liturgical innovations together, and he's giving them the ideology. Remember, just to repeat, the first generation of reform we saw, it was all about aesthetics. It was all about changes in the synagogue, making it look more like the Protestant church, bringing in the organ, creating decorum, responsive reading, all these sorts of things, German prayers. And the idea was that we make the synagogue more appealing and there we'll keep Jews in it. In fact, in the early years, In the early years of Geiger, he sort of followed this path. He thought that his job was just, let's affirm what people are doing. And we can justify it scholarly. But then he assumes a more activist stance. That is, the job of the rabbi is not just to affirm what people are feeling and doing, but the rabbis have to push the development, because after all, they're the leaders. And it would be his scholarship that would move history. Well, as we saw, the first thing is to destroy the authority of the Talmud, which he does to his satisfaction, and then to destroy even the Torah, or most of it. And once you do that, you can create a new form of Judaism. Now, what he attempts to do is show through his scholarship, and he was a great scholar, no question about it, how Judaism has changed enormously in the past. If I can show you that Judaism has changed enormously, then why should it stop changing? If I can show you that Judaism changed from the Bible to the Pharisees, to the sages, and if I can then show you that after the destruction of the temple, the Pharisees recreated Judaism, if I can show you all these things, then Judaism must continue to change. And if I show you that, then reform is not a radical break. No, reform is the continuation. And it's the rabbis, the traditionalists, the Chasam Sofer, they're the modern Sadducees. So again, the question is going to be, who is going to be able to assume the mantle of the Pharisees? And that's what Geiger's scholarship was about, to show development of halakha, how rabbinic Judaism is this development, but only one possible development. There could be other possible developments. The Sadducees also had halakha, Geiger will tell us. And once you say that halakha is a development, and it's one development of any number of developments, the rabbis could have developed it in a different way, well, then there's nothing sacrosanct to it. When you read Geiger, as I said, you see such scholarship. He could have been a real goon had he put his mind to it. Now, unlike Frankel, who we will discuss, Geiger set no limits to his scholarship. So higher biblical criticism was also accepted. And nothing is off the table. You have two types of biblical criticism, for those who are unaware. You have lower biblical criticism, like you deal with words, texts, the problems in the text. Should it read this word or that word? I mean, some of them are clearly over the top. One of the early reformers, Radical Maskevim, Yehuda HaShashur, he even said the very first book of the verse of the Torah, Bereshis Bohim Es HaShamayim Ves HaAretz. God, should it say? Bereshis Bohim Es HaMayim Ves HaAretz, which I think is so foolish, because it's obvious God creates the heavens and the earth, but Shore thought it should be Mayim and Aretz. But we do have other examples where there could be problems, let's say, how to read a word. And we know that in the Midrash and Gemara, they have different readings. That's lower criticism, especially when you leave Torah into Nach. Higher criticism deals with authorship, documents. And I'm sure most of you know about the higher criticism that was developed in Protestant Germany, by the way, by Wellhausen, although he wasn't the first, it was back before him. But Wellhausen was also, like Geiger, he was a clergyman. He was a Protestant clergyman, as were many of the early Bible critics. And much like the Protestant clergyman, it took Geiger a while before he felt comfortable in speaking about these things, because he was worried about, would he be thrown out of his synagogue? Would it be a problem? And by the way, many reform, Isaac Meir Wise, who we spoke about, he, in Hebrew Union College, refused to allow higher criticism to be taught. This wasn't an assumption that all Reform Jews would adopt it. Isaac Meir Wise didn't want Louis Ginsberg to teach there because he thought Louis Ginsberg held to the higher criticism, and Isaac Meir Wise is Reform. So Louis Ginsberg goes to the seminary, but we know that Salman Schachter hated higher criticism. He called it the higher anti-Semitism, which because part of these Protestant Bible critics was they wanted to show that the Old Testament is like decadent and represents an earlier, a primitive phase, like the fossil, like to use Toynbee's expression, the fossil period of Judaism, and that Christianity is the fruition of what real religion is. And they really looked with contempt upon Jews. I mean, holding on to these backward ceremonies. Occasionally you'll meet Christians who have that attitude today, but it's pretty rare. It was very Germanic. Meyer says about Geiger as follows on page 93. The cumulative effect of Geiger's critical work was thus to historicize and therefore relativize every sacred text of Judaism. Everything, biblical and rabbinic, each reflected its age of origin. None stood above its historical milieu. Whatever history had produced, ongoing history could alter, even abolish. So we're all on a we're on a cycle here, and we're not bound to anything. Now, this doesn't mean for Geiger that you throw out everything in the past. Some things will still have value, but we only keep them if they have value. They don't have value because of anything in the past. They only have value if today they inspire us. So Geiger starts writing about, in his writings, he starts focusing on the Pharisees, the Prussian. And Pharisees is a bad word in Christianity. In the New Testament, the Pharisees are portrayed as these reactionaries, people hyper-literal, who only care about the law, don't care about spirit, you know, completely at odds with the fact we're all descendants of the Pharisees. And our rabbinic Judaism is Pharisaic Judaism. So, and you have descriptions there in the New Testament that, you can't violate Shabbos to save someone. We know that's false. And Pharisaic Judaism is far from the description that you would get hypocritical and all those ways the term Pharisaical was used. But Geiger focuses on the Pharisees, and he doesn't adopt the Christian approach. In fact, he adopts a very different, very, at least in his mind, a sympathetic approach. But he sees them as radical innovators, radical reformers, because after the destruction of the temple, Judaism need to be recreated. And that's what they did. He was interested, not like Steinschneider, who wanted, as I said, to give Judaism a burial, a decent burial. That's not what his scholarship was about. No, he's using his scholarship about the Pharisees to show how Reform Judaism is continuing the Pharisaical tradition, because the Pharisees are reformers. No more and no less. Therefore, what is Reform Judaism? It's not some crazy idea or anything like that. Reform Judaism is not some new invention. Reform Judaism is part and parcel of the tradition. And Reform Judaism is the rabbinic tradition before it went into some sort of hibernation for, 1,500 years or so, with codification and everything like that. What Geiger says is that we are the modern day Pharisees. Unlike the Pharisees of old, we don't believe the Torah is divine, but we are the Pharisees. Because we know how to deal with changes, we update things. The rabbis of today, they're the Sadducees, and they're going to die out just like the Sadducees in the past. Why did the Sadducees die out? The Sadducees die out because they were trying to be loyal to the past, but they couldn't live in the present. They didn't know how to move with the times. Similarly, in the 19th century, these rabbis and these traditionalist communities, they call them Orthodox, they don't know how to live with the times, so they'll be forgotten. So how did they recreate Judaism, the Pharisees? It used to be a priestly religion. It used to be focused on the temple. They're the ones who turned it into a book religion, a religion of the people. Things I'm sure many of you have heard about. The Pharisees become dominant after the temple's destroyed because they're the only ones speaking about a Judaism that's not tied to the land or not tied to the temple. Incidentally, in his work, in Geiger's great work that we'll talk more about, where he deals with the translations. It's about the original text and the translation of the Bible. He deals a lot with the Sadducees, and he even says that you can find Sadducees ideas in Agadic literature. But even though the Pharisees were dominant, as can be seen from the Mishnah and the Talmud. Now, again, people might say this is heretical, but I'll tell you that Agada comes from different places. All sorts of contradictory ideas are found in it. There's all sorts of midrashim at different levels of authority. The idea that we can't speak about the philosophy of the rabbis. There's so many different ideas. We have individuals mentioned in the Agadot, Yaakov Naburaya, who says you have to do shchita on fish. I mean, what is this? Is he a sectarian? He's quoted in the Agada, but some hold that he's a sectarian. the Chasam Sofer says that if you look in the Targum on Ruth, the way it describes there one of the forms of Misa, the Chasam Sofer wonders whether the Targum on Ruth is of its Saduki origin. So the idea that you'd have in huge corpus of rabbinic literature, you'd have these ideas that slipped in, that in and of itself is not enough to make Geiger out of the fold. Geiger's out of the fold for everything else he's saying. These are just radical ideas, but it's not enough. Leo Jung from good German Orthodox stock. I was even shocked. I want to find out when he left the Aguda, because I'm reading all these old Jewish forums from the 20s, and Leo Jung is an Agudist of Agudists. He's even an Agudist supporting Rabbi Sonnenfeld, not Rav Kook. This is not the Rabbi Jung from the 50s and 60s. He was a strong German Orthodox Agudist. He wrote a book. You can see it on the Google Books, Fallen Angels in Rabbinic Literature. And right in the introduction, he says that, you know, we're going to be looking at some of these things, and we have to understand that not every idea that's mentioned in the Gaudic literature is Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, that certain things have come in and there's been influence. I understand that's Kafira maybe in certain circles, but that's what he says. And this gets us to Rabbi Dunner, because Rabbi Dunner makes the same claim. He says that, and this is why the rabbis of Frankfurt wanted to put him in Chayrim, and I got to publish the material Professor Breuer gave me, but because he says that there are things in the Gemara. Now, hold on to your seats. But I mentioned this before, but I'll give you some new examples now. He says that there are things in the Gemara, part of the Shaka Vatari and other things, that were inserted by people who wanted to mock the sages, and somehow it got in. And I'm going to repeat the ones examples I gave you in the past too. Then I'll give you a new one, and then I'll wait to hear who else says this. He gives a number of examples. But the two I think you'll appreciate, and I'll give you another one. He says, I'll pull it up the Gemara. Now, I don't agree with him, but this is what he was doing it as a way of defending the glory of the sages. But this is what he says. These are some of the ones he points to. He doesn't believe that the holy Chazal could have ever said this. So here you have in Yoma. Hold on, is it... Rav, when Rav would come to the city, he would declare, who will be married to me for the day? In other words, he gets married and then he'll divorce her. What's going on here? The holy Rav comes to town and says they want a wife for a night? Now, today we can understand this perhaps because there's even to this day in Iranian culture, and this has been incorporated in Shia Islam, you have this concept of a wife for a day. So maybe you can see this as in its Iranian context, but Rabbi Dunner thought that this was to mock the holy Rav. He gave another example. This is another one I've mentioned in the past, but we have new people here. It's Bava Kama, it's also mentioned in Yavamos. Rabba says, if a man fell from a roof and while falling was inserted into a woman due to the force of the fall, but he had not had the intention to engage in sexual intercourse, he's liable to pay the four types of indemnity. Look at the case. The man is falling off, and as he's falling off the roof, he lands on a woman and does the act, and then they deal with the implications. What's the halachas about this? Rabbi Dunner says that this is clearly mocking the Chazal. These are people, leitzanim, who want to mock the sages because he doesn't. I mean, I understand the sages would come up with all sorts of crazy cases. It's not an actual case. They're deriving halachic principles from it, but Rabbi Dunner says this is too much. And then he gives another example. His example is from Cholin. Hold on a second here. Cholin, where's Cholin? Yes, Cholin. Jacob, I can hear you. Got my son. I gotta keep him quiet. Cholin. It says as follows. Cholin 139b. If one found a nest in the sky, that's not the one I want to tell you. If you find a nest in the sky, that is the bird is carrying the nest. Is there a mitzvah of sending away the mother bird? Then it says, If, let's say, you find the nest on the head of a person, what's the halacha then? So Rabbi Dunner thinks that these are just examples of, they're mocking the rabbis. You know, you want to know if you have to do chasing away the mother bird. If a guy's walking around with a nest on his head, hold on. But I want to show you something now. Because believe it or not, it's not just Rabbi Dunner. It's not just some of these modern people. There's other examples. But my favorite is the Meiri. Look what the Meiri says. I want to show you something here that the Meiri says. Meiri, important person, obviously. The Meiri on 86B, the Gemara says as follows. Anything that the Baal Bas says to you, you're supposed to do, chutz mitzei, unless he says to leave. Now, by the way, if you look in our Gemaras, it's in parentheses. It's in parentheses because if you look in the Dukei Sofrim, you'll see that some manuscripts didn't have it. But it appears clear that it is part of the original. And it's quoted by Rishonim, and they didn't know that this wasn't found in certain manuscripts. But understand what this Gemara is saying. Hey, whatever you're in Baal Abbas, you come to someone's house, whatever he says to do, he tells you to take out the trash, do it. But if he says to leave, don't do it. What do you mean don't do it? How could you not do it? It's his house. So they give different explanations of what it means. One explanation is... I wrote down a couple explanations here. One explanation, I think it's the Marsha, says if he says to you, go buy me something in the store, then you could say, no, I'm here as the guest. Don't tell me to go buy you something. But the Meiri says as follows on this. Because, again, it's hard to understand. What do you mean? It's his house. He tells you to leave. What do you say? No, I'm squatting here. Listen to what the Meiri says on this in the Beis Bechira. It's on page 341 if you want to look at the Beis Bechira. He says, the Meiri knows the different versions. He says, you shouldn't read these words, chutz mitzei, even though it's found in some texts. He says, this is haga'as leitzanim, nishtabshu ba'asfarim. The Meiri says that this passage, chutz mitzei, which is found in most texts and which is explained, he says it should be taken out because it was put in by leitzanim, jokers. What does it mean, jokers? The original text of the Gemara says whatever the Baal HaBayis says to do, you should do. And then the joker trying to mock it says, unless he tells you to leave, then don't leave. We can see that that's a joke. So the Meiri is telling us, and I have a whole list of examples of traditional authorities that speak about this idea of interpolations. The Meiri says that this is an interpolation, that somehow the leitzanim got it in. Now, I don't know realistically if this is possible. If you can imagine a scenario where leitzanim could have got their things in, and Rabbi Dunner, where he gives a whole bunch of examples here, where people, how does that work? The Talmud is controlled by the rabbis. They're just going to, someone writes a text and then it gets into the hands of the rabbis and then they just incorporate it. I guess in theory it's possible. They incorporate it into the final version, but then you're saying that the people who formulated the Talmud didn't recognize this. So we're dealing with Savarin, you're not a Marain, but still it's. I just mention this only so you know that this is, you do find this in traditional sources. What I'm going to continue when we get back is I want to get more into Geiger's ideas. Why he thought that reform was the wave of the future, how he saw orthodoxy, and into his book, The Bible and Its Translations, the Urschrift, we know it, Urschrift and Übersetzungen, and some of his, and we'll also deal with some of his history, because he's also a rabbi, and that's a problem, because how do you have someone like Geiger if he's the rabbi of your community? And we'll deal with what happens, the Tiktins. We'll deal with some traditionalist rabbis. And what do you do in a community when a Geiger is appointed? That sort of thing. And Next class, maybe even we'll get to the famous murder or supposed murder of the Reform rabbi. Were the Orthodox guilty or not? We will get to that. So here, let me take the questions here. Nothing the next 2 weeks. And then after that, they'll be for 2 weeks. So in other words, in 2 weeks, you'll get an email saying that I'll be giving the class. I'm supposed to be away. If something happens and I don't go away, then we'll change and we'll send it out. But I'm going to Tunisia in right after Shavuos. So that's the plan. Rabbi Hartman says, I believe Rabbi Saul Berman was active in civil rights. He was arrested down south. He was poor. He read the McGill in jail and he told the sheriff what he's doing. You know, I didn't know that. I knew he was interested and he was involved, but I didn't know he was arrested and I didn't know he actually went down south. So I think today we see this as a Kiddush Hashem. We think it's a nice thing. During the time, I know that the people looked at these young rabbis, I guess Rabbi Flasher and Rabbi Berman, as troublemakers and rocking the boat. And that's all we need. The Klan, you know, for once, the Klan, the anti-Semites are not focusing on the Jews. They're focusing on someone else. And here you're going to go down. It's very nice for their attitude was people, the Jews living in, let's say, in Montgomery and in Atlanta. It's very nice that these Northerners come down and they make their thing, but then they leave after the weekend. And we are living down here. And now all of a sudden the Klan and the rest of them, they now look at us as the enemy when we were flying under the radar. So I know that's how they were viewed as troublemakers. Rabbi Lichtenstein also spoke about civil rights a good deal. Okay, so there's someone privately texted me. I said that Hechel Torah, he says there was a yeshiva. Hechel Torah yeshiva was in Harlem. It was run by Rabbi London. You're going to have to illuminate me because I don't know who Rabbi London is either. And you're telling me in the 60s there was a yeshiva in Harlem? That's, you know, Jeffrey Gurak wrote a book when Harlem was Jewish. But by the 60s, it wasn't Jewish. It had stopped being Jewish by then. But that's interesting. I didn't know anything about that. Moshe says, could Olam Natzeach and Ginot be referred to the tune which the child is taught? I guess so, but that, remember, the Gemara doesn't say that. The Gemara says the teacher per umnus. So it's just, it's a little strange that it was changed. Mike says, the Heter to not teach Parnassa relies on the opinion of Rav Nahor Rai, that he puts away all the umnus in the world and he only teaches son Torah. But the Gemara says that the lesson that they the final story is that it doesn't work out for you. I forget though. I need to check. I think I can't remember the Rambam. I'm going to look. I think the Rambam. I don't think that he mentions it, but I think he mentions it elsewhere. He doesn't. Now it's coming back to me. The Rambam doesn't mention it where you'd expect him to mention, but he does mention that if you're teaching the child, I think he says it, and you injure him, you're putter, and everyone says that is the proof that it's a mitzvah because you're putter, because you wouldn't be putter if it wasn't a mitzvah. That if you beat the kid to teach him something optional, but if you're teaching him something which he needs to know, I think that. So the Rambam does mention it, but he doesn't say explicitly like halacha. And the thing about swimming, that's not mentioned either. Mark says if some people carry money, aren't they putting in danger those who don't? I don't know. So they come to the people who don't have money, and then they open up their pockets. They don't have money. I don't know. Maybe that's not your concern. The concern is. At the end of the day, it was a little far-fetched because you have to assume that the guy is going to hurt you or kill you if you don't have money. Why would he kill you if you don't have money? He might just because he's crazy. I mean, but the people today in New York are killing you. They don't even care about money. They just pick up a gun and they just shoot you for the heck of it. That's so I don't know. That's why really this is something you'd ask a postsake whether you could or not. And we saw what the Ramosha said. Ramosha said that no. So Avi tells me, thank you, Avi, that it was Rabbi Wolgamu's son who was killed. So now I'm really upset because I went to school with a Wolgamu, and I'm thinking maybe then it's her father. That's unfortunate. Wolgamuth. Wolgamuth's an old German rabbinic family associated with the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary. Great philosopher Joseph Wolgamuth, and then you have, this is Isaiah Wolgamuth, but Wolgamuth's old good German Jews. Mel says some don't say Birch Shemay because it's from the Zohar. Yes, that's true. That's we saw last class, that in Frankfurt they didn't say it because it was from the Zohar. They want to incorporate the Zohar, but we say it to non-Frankfurt Jews. But then we spoke about how there was a problem. Some have a problem with this expression Bar Elohim, and that's what we started dealing with. And someone privately reminds me that Rabbi Hamburger in Shor Shei Menag Ashkenaz has a very detailed discussion of Brich Shemay, especially and dealing with Bar Elohim. So I'll have to take a look at that again. And David mentions that Bar Elohim is a translation of Bnei Elohim in Bereishit, which we understand to mean important people. Yeah, I mentioned that last class. But I don't know if it works in Brich Shemay, because in Brich Shemay, you say, I don't rely on people. What sense would it make, David, to say, I don't rely on man, I don't rely on important men? That doesn't read properly. That's why it makes more sense here that they're using the Daniel, they're using the meaning in Daniel, I don't rely on man, and I don't rely on angel, I only rely on God. Isn't that what we say in the Haggadah? We weren't brought forth, you know, from an angel, but by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. I think that's pshat. I'm going to have to take a look at what Rabbi Hamburger, I'm sure, as Kedarko Bakodesh, he cites all the different sources. And David says, Nechama Leibowitz explains that the pshat of Ayin Tachanayim is indeed monetary. Okay, so that's sort of what I was saying. But that doesn't mean that it ever was understood to be done literally, any more than the Rashbam, who says the pshat is that the day starts in the morning, thinks that the day that we should start the day in the morning. But that's the pshat. Ruth tells us in the Hirsch Siddur, Bar Elohim is translated angel. Yes, thank you. I think that's pshat. Chaim says that the Birmum Siddur is not so cheap as you're expected. Well, you know, you come to a number of shuls, you can find lots of them. The latest RCA Siddur, I don't have it with me. It's upstairs now. I'm going to look. I am certain. If anyone has the RCA Siddur, the new one, handy, please open it up, that they translate Bar Elohim as angel. This was such a controversy in the 60s. So if no one gets it before we finish within 5 minutes, but someone's going to get it, tell me what they translate it as, because it has to be angel. Yeah, the Koran Siddur for, no, the Koran Siddur for in Britain omits Brich Shemay, not the Koran Siddur for Americans. It doesn't omit it. And David says, Bereishis Elohim Esa Shamayim Esa Aretz, instead of Shamayim, is not such a stretch, as one of the early Achronim explained the etymology of Shamayim as Shemayim, which is significant. Okay. When you say Justin Sachs has it, it all depends which version, the English version or not. And Harvey says that Ruth Calderon, she's secular, she's a member of Knesset, but used to be. I don't think she still is, but she's a Talmudist. And finally, David says he always thought the examples in The Bride for the Night are Rav and Rav Nachman, both of which are told as having serious shalom bias issues with their wives. Okay, I hadn't thought of that.
Translates it as angel.
Angel, the new RCA Siddur. Yes. Oh, yeah, thank you very much. That's the shot. And Marty says, did Geiger believe that any reform could be heretical? After all, anything can be Jewish and nothing is Jewish. No, what he thinks is that the word heretical doesn't have any significance. It's not. There's no such thing as heretical. You can do reforms, as we'll see, if you want to get rid of Hebrew, if you're going to move the Sabbath to Sunday. There are certain things you can do which destroy Jewish continuity, but you can't use the word heretical. That's not really a term used, but it's not helpful. And the last thing I want to get to, Rivka says the whole statement from Pesachim of the Baal Bayis seemed tongue-in-cheek. Why should he be obligated to do whatever your host tells you to do? Well, he's hosting you. I think when they say whatever, it means, doesn't mean, you know, cut your hair off or anything like that. It means that you're supposed to show Hakaras HaTov. And according to the explanation I gave, what it means is that you're supposed to do anything except if it's overboard. If he says, go out and buy me something at the store, it'll take you 2 hours to go there. You know, that's Hachlasas Arachim doesn't mean that you have a servant now or a slave. Hachlasas Arachim means that you have someone and you're doing a mitzvah and that he should do things. He should clean his plate and things like that. But it doesn't mean that you can then send him off to do errands. That's the pshat. Barry says that he was rabbi of Young Israel of Brookline, respected Islamist as Talmud of the Rav, but not like his liberalism. Are you referring to, I don't know who you're referring to, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg? Did I mention Yitz Greenberg? He was a rabbi of Young Israel of Brookline. So I don't know.
Rabbi Saul Berman, Mark.
Oh, right, Saul Berman, yes, he was a rabbi there. Yeah.
Saul Berman. He went to Berkeley, I believe.
Okay. And finally, someone privately emails me that Brishame is in the original German, her sitter. Brich Shimei is part of this, is part of our Siddur for a long time, and it's a very nice prayer, and if you read it as Angel, what's the issue, what's the problem? We include it, it's from the Zohar. In our communities, we include Kabbalistic things, so I don't, one thing I do, I'll end with this, is that sometimes people are so, I don't know the word for it, chanyok, I guess, about every repetition. So someone was hocking a chaynik that you shouldn't say bay, bay on arachets, because you're repeating bay twice. So just say bay on arachets. So, I mean, okay, you know, this isn't in Shmon Esrei. This isn't, there's, you know, it's the Aruch HaShulchan is even Mohammed Tzvos in areas where you can't have a hefsek if you're repeating the same. Even Moshe says it's okay, technically. It's not like you're saying, like the Chazonim used to say, they used to say in Musaf, they used to say in one of the Kedushas from Musaf that you skip the whole middle thing here. I can't remember now which one it was. I am a kom kevodo. They'd skip the whole middle one. I mean, to say bay on arachitz, I mean, I don't think you need to get, in my humble opinion, I don't think you need to get worked up if the chazan, and I say this, the reason I'm thinking about this is because in my show, we have a small little outdoor minion. I think I'm going to be away for Shavuos, so I could be extra careful. So I went there. We only had like 12. So lo and behold, they gave me shachris. So I take out the Torah and I say, I repeat bay. So as I repeated it, I'm thinking about the guy who's in the indoor minion, who knows we're good friends. So he knows, but I've told him I don't hold of this. I was thinking, oh no, I repeated bay. But I hold it's okay to repeat bay.
It used to be, you know, they would go bay on arachis, bay, and then they go higher. You know.
And they go back. I just repeated. I just said bay.
That they cut out. You never hear that anymore. They would go, how does it go? Bay on arachis, bay on
arachis.
So that you never hear anymore. They taka only do the bay on arachis.
I'm curious, before we go from our Washington Heights person, is there any repetition of words in Washington Heights, the old Chazonis? Because they know Chazonis there.
No.
Because they do in Basel. Basel is also German Orthodox. They do repeat, not skipping, but they repeat a word twice, you know, back to back. Which, as I said, Ramosha doesn't think it's a hefsek, although he doesn't think he thinks it's not such a good idea. The Aruch HaShulchan is more tolerant, but today we're very mocked. The Rav was very much against it. The Rav was against repeating words. And he thought that this was about chazanim showing off. And I remember I had a son in high school whose father was a chazan, and he got very annoyed at the Rav. The Rav doesn't understand chazanus. This isn't about showing off or anything like that.
I forget, Mark, who is it? Is it the Tiferet Yisrael? Somebody says if it mixes in with the tune, then it's allowed.
Yehuda says that.
I'm sorry?
Yehuda
quoted that to us once. I don't think he liked that so much, but he quoted us. That I forget. I think it was the Tiferet Yisrael. I could be wrong. Who said that? Anytime, you know, they make up who. Chadesh, Chadesh, Yameinu, Chadesh.
Well, that's Ramosha. Ramosha thought technically
it's
not a problem.
It's a tune. It's mutter because it didn't happen.
And Professor Jose Faurzal, he actually said to us and said to me that the tune, traditional tune. Takes precedence over other things, and we just go with it. And he said that was true of the Syrian community and I would be visiting and staying with him. So,
did he mean repeating, or did he mean in terms of pronunciation?
It would be the repeating. If a phrase happened to be repeated, that it was just part of the community and their tradition, and they do it.
So what the real problem is, this is a problem. This is what we're going to absolutely would be. When I was young, Chazanim would say, Kevodo ma'ale ma'ale olam aye mekom kevodo. That you're destroying the matbeah of the bracha. You're skipping the middle. So what Professor Faur is also could be referring to, we discussed in the past, is that sometimes the tune doesn't work with the stress, and that we will stress, let's say, the final syllable, even though it shouldn't be stressed, that because that makes the tune, and we understand that's poetry, we do that. So that's no one, as far as I know, says that that's a problem. Okay, well, thank you, Rabbi.
Okay, wish you Chag Sameach, since next week is Shavuot, and we look forward to seeing you, I guess, in 3 weeks in a nice trip, I guess, planning a future tour and motion trip one day.
We hope. There was a huge crowd in Gerba. My daughter was there with a group of Princeton students. There was Robbie Berman, if anyone knows Robbie Berman. He used to be head of Halachic Organ Donor Society. He contacted me a week before. He wanted to go. Lo and behold, he works for Israeli television. He did a whole television thing. You can find it on YouTube. I can send it to you from Gerba. And it was very, very nice. And there was a guy from Brooklyn College who contacted me who went. So hopefully, although Tunisia does not have relations with Israel, this is a sign of softening that, they do the whole where we don't. And there were a lot of Israelis there. But we don't accept Israel, but we don't have a problem with Jews and even Israelis, sort of. We don't. It's like with Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is investing $2 billion now in Israel. That it's only a matter of time before.
Today's paper, the Jerusalem Post, I think today had a report that about 100 Israeli businessmen have gone or are going to to Saudi Arabia. We live in a really strange world. What can I tell you? But
I'll report back in 3 weeks.
Okay. All right. Laila Tov, everybody. We look forward to seeing you soon. As I always, invite a friend, and we look forward to learning with you. And okay, be well. Thank you.
Chodesh Tov.
Chodesh Tov. Yeah, I forgot. Yeah, Rosh Chodesh Tov. Chodesh Tov. We should hear Chaim Tovim, Shel Bracha, Parnasa, Chilutza, somewhat all the things we said on Shabbos. Okay, everybody, be well. Look forward to seeing you soon. Wednesday, I guess, is our next two classes, our next three classes, actually, on Wednesday. Okay. Have a good night. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Tada-da-ba.